Hello and welcome to this week's Alpha Podcast. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined again by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm very well, thanks, John.
Good. Hunkering down for lockdown two?
I'm always hunkered down.
It's a bit of a strange time. And we've got some companies we want to talk about who may or may not be impacted by yet another shutdown of large chunks of the economy. I think we're going to talk about Sainsbury's, which in the context of the grocery industry, and we had some numbers from Ocado this week, which actually looked very good, could be something to keep an eye on. We're going to talk about Auto Trader and the automotive sector in the UK, which, defying everyone's expectations, has done extremely well over the last few months, the industry as a whole and Auto Trader as well. And then there's a couple of other companies that I think you wanted to talk about, ABF and Senior, to take us on a little bit of detail. Should we start with Sainsbury's? I mean, let's start with lockdown. What do you make of all this?
I'm not sure what to make of it, which makes me very similar to most people. I think there's no point reasoning, you know, why other people have gone into that. I think what is clear is that it's not good. It's not good for the economy. And We've had little sort of insights into it with these local tiered lockdowns, and you've seen trading updates from pub companies which have been telling you how bad it is. Now these companies have been going from maybe 50% of what they would expect in terms of revenue to nothing again. You know, we're told that this is all going to end on December the 2nd. I think yesterday when the government came out and said that the furlough scheme was going to last, is it March the 21st? I think is the day.
Yes, it's definitely sometime in 2021 in March.
That to me is just, you know, the government covering its backside to extend the lockdown, because I don't think any sort of considered opinion on the virus believes that a 4-week lockdown is going to get the numbers under control.
So this is going to be a pretty horrible winter for lots and lots of sectors. You mentioned pubs already. Hospitality must. I mean, this is their busiest time of year. This is when they make a huge amount of their money going into the Christmas period. The same with retailers. And you have to look across those two sectors and think companies aren't going to survive this. If they can't trade in the period of the year where they make most of their money, that's it. They've got to be toast.
Yeah, I mean, you look at like a lot of general retailers, and you know, this. I mean, obviously, don't forget that these companies can still trade online, and will trade online aggressively to try and make this up. But you know, it's not uncommon for many retailers, general retailers, to make 75-80% of their annual profit at Christmas. And you know, their annual profits, how good they are, how much they grow, how much they are against analysts' expectations and therefore their share prices, hinge on this, I don't know, 8 to 10 weeks of Christmas trading activity. And it's bound to reduce it. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Yeah, and not all retailers have made as much progress online as they perhaps should have done. So, you know, we saw some trading figures from Dunelm this week, which were decent. They've done a very, very good job, as we spoke about recently, of switching their model to more of an online one, obviously with the company by Click and Collect. But then we've seen other retailers really struggle to move quite as quickly online. And actually going online just takes them up against some of the pure play guys. You know, suddenly you've got this big, fearsome Amazon competitor lurking in the background. And then everything comes down to sort of logistics and delivery. So, yeah, I can see this being a very difficult time for perhaps some of the less nimble retailers. M&S, for example, have never quite nailed their online offer. And you do worry that they're really going to get really hit hard this Christmas.
It's not just about the scale of online sales versus sales in store, but it's whether the companies are set up, have set their online business up in the right way, and, you know, more importantly, a way that they can make profits from. I wrote an article a few weeks back about, and we talked about it on the podcast, about food retail and delivery, and how the delivery cost is making it very difficult to serve customers in an affordable way and allow them to make profits, because the margins are so wafer thin, and the costs associated with serving the customer online are so high that even though you can get all these sales through, it's actually very difficult to make meaningful profits from it.
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, we saw some pretty decent numbers from Ocado, which are in this week's magazine. But you know, the question we're asking there is, you know, how long can that continue? You know, if everybody's doing the same thing, you know, Ocado, as you have pointed out many times, struggled to make money despite, you know, being very, very high growth. And you've got Tesco coming along, you know, offering you know, a very good internet delivery service. Sainsbury's obviously trying the same with a bit less success. You know, it's going to be brutal. It's going to get even more brutal, you'd imagine.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, Ocado is showing a bit of leverage now. It's showing that. I mean, the thing about Ocado, which is frustrating, is it talks about EBITDA. EBITDA is not a proper measure of profit in a business where, you know, you have delivery vans. You know, they don't last forever. They need to be replaced. Software doesn't last forever. It needs to be updated and replaced. So, you know, when my view is that when you take into account, you know, replacement expenditure, then there isn't much trading or operating profit here. It's getting better. There is some operational leverage here, which is, you know, profits increasing faster than sales. But there's not much, to be frank with. I think you've seen a step change this year with Ocado. But Ocado's profit margins on its measure are not yet up to the level of what the core supermarkets are making, selling predominantly from a supermarket store.
Yeah, and you talk about scale. I mean, you know, just to give a flavour of that, Ocado does about 345,000 orders a week. Tesco has doubled its capacity to 1.5 million. Sainsbury's is up to 700,000. So Ocado's still pretty small in the grand scheme of things. And it's been chipping away at this for a long, long time.
It has. And, you know, the thing about capacity, you know, this is the thing. You have to match in capacity with demand, and then leveraging that capacity so you can make some incremental profits out of it is a real challenge in this industry. I mean, I think most people think that more people, hopefully one day we come to an end of all this, and I think there will be more people who will stick with deliveries. I think one of the things that crosses my mind is that, you know, Sainsbury's and Tesco have expanded capacity so significantly. There could be a case where we come out of this and people are so keen just to get out, you know, and go out and actually go and visit the supermarket and get out and about, that they actually have too much capacity.
Well, Tesco's is planning to build 25 what he calls urban fulfillment centres to cope with its online business. I mean, that's a lot of capacity that it's putting into the market. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely something to keep an eye on. Should we talk about Sainsbury's quickly, who had some numbers this week? They were a bit rubbish.
I don't know. I looked into that. I thought they were actually all right, actually. Apart from the bank, which went from a small profit into a quite a significant loss.
We saw the same with Tesco, to be fair. So, you know, I think that's just the way things are at the moment.
Things like provisions for bad debt and that kind of thing is things like travel money as well is an earner for these companies. And that's obviously taken a big hit. I find Sainsbury's a really, you know, quite an interesting case study because it doesn't do anything particularly well. And I don't mind that to sound overly critical, maybe a bad choice of words, but you know it isn't the best operator in the sector, and it certainly isn't the lowest cost operator. So it's not doing anything that others don't do, and it isn't doing it cheaper than anybody else. And those are often the two main drivers of any significant competitive edge that a business has: doing something that others don't, or doing it cheaply than others do. Sainsbury's does neither. And, you know, the business has struggled to grow its profits and is reliant on continually restructuring and cutting costs and changing its business. And that's what's going on now, you know, particularly with Argos. And I think there's actually some quite good things going on with Argos, with its general merchandise, and things like Habitat and clothing. I actually think Sainsbury's is actually quite well positioned here. I think it has an offer for customers through Argos, through clothing, through homeware, that actually is good value and good range. And I can actually see Sainsbury's doing quite well. And particularly at Christmas, while some of its competitors might be closed, in this part of the market. The key problem for Sainsbury's, and it freely admitted this, is that it cannot shake the perception that it's too expensive a place to shop. And I think that perception is a correct perception by customers, and I'm not sure how it can fix it. I mean, what it's trying to do is it's trying to take 600 million of cost out and throw the savings into online business, convenience stores, and cutting prices. But my problem with Sainsbury's is that its business, it's got a lot of very, very big stores, and it hasn't got enough customers going through the doors or clicking their mice on the internet.
Well, isn't the strategy, though, to essentially migrate the Argos portfolio into those very large stores so that it has a well-established click-and-collect premises to really drive the non-food side of things? And it's closing a lot of Argos standalone stores. Yeah. That's a big part of what it announced in these results here, which sounds sensible.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, that is the non-food strategy, and I think that makes a lot of sense because, you know, I just mentioned a few seconds ago about these big stores, and the problem is that, you know, there's not enough revenue per square foot on these stores to make them stack up. Shifting Argos into them helps address that. And it improves the economics of Argos. It lowers the cost to serve the consumer. It makes the management of stock, which is vitally important, not just in terms of the amount of it, but the accessibility to it, so much better. And I think this is a good thing that Sainsbury's are doing. And I think that this will help them possibly over the long term. The key thing with Argos is, How does it go toe to toe with Amazon? You know, how does it? You know, it's up against Amazon in this kind of general merchandise, general retail, general everything type of market. What I think's just going back to the grocery side of it, because I think this is obviously still the main driver of profit. I think that Sainsbury's always tends to be playing a game of catch up on price. It never leads on price, and it's always tried to trade on quality. And I think that the problem with that now is that the quality of what its competitors are offering has gone up a lot, and therefore Sainsbury's is no longer offering anything special that allows it to get away with charging premium prices. And so what it has to do, it has to cut prices, and hopefully it drives more footfall or more online customers in response. And that's where there is a huge uncertainty. And this has been the battle that Sainsbury's has been playing for the last 20 years.
I was going to say, it feels like we've been here before. It feels like we've been here since I was a retail correspondent, and that was a very long time ago.
Yeah, yeah. And I will say one thing that I think is interesting is that on their online business, 20% of their online grocery business now is click and collect. And I think click and collect is definitely the way to go on online grocery for a very simple reason that you're taking the delivery cost element out of it.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's true across all retail. That's true across all retail. It's the most profitable business because obviously, yeah. As you say,
Dunelm, you know, exactly. You mentioned, yeah, doing really well with that. And I think that this is the thing that, and I'm, you know, trying to persuade, obviously consumers, a lot of them people just like to sit at home and have a van come and deliver it to their door. But sooner or later, I think there's going to have to be a reckoning on this and that companies are going to have to put their hand up and say, look, either you're going to have to pay more to have this delivered, or you're going to have to come and pick it up.
Yeah, I think there could be some crunch in that logistics side of things at some point. I think you're absolutely right. That's why these businesses don't really make enough money, because they're absorbing these enormous costs of getting the goods out to people's homes. Ricardo's always going to struggle in that respect, unless people can pick up from Marks and Spencer, maybe. But
I think this is the thing that the main supermarkets have over Ricardo, is that they have this huge network of local stores. You know, it's just this concept known as like a dark store, where you can actually change the makeup and the configuration of your store to serve your online business. And also then you cut the length of delivery. So you cut, you don't cut delivery at all. You cut delivery as well. But also the consumer doesn't have to go that far to pick it up, hopefully. The economics are complicated. The getting it all sorted out, you know, things like frozen food and that kind of thing. But this is the way to go. And I think the supermarkets have got the platform to do this.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I mean, and actually, if you look at M&S, who obviously Ocado now works with, a lot of their food stores tend to be in the middle of a high street, in the middle of a station, where actually parking's really quite difficult. Whereas, you know, your Tesco's and Sainsbury's do actually have very large car parks where it's easy to drive into and pick up your stuff. Actually, and I don't know whether this is sort of reflective of Sainsbury's click and collect strategy, if you go to my local Tesco, there is a dedicated click and collect point where you actually, and it's been there for years, and you drive through and you pick your stuff up. When during lockdown we did the same from Sainsbury's, they'd actually driven one of their delivery vans out the back, and you were click and collecting out the back of their delivery van. And this was a brand new store, so you know. And when I thought about that, I thought perhaps they haven't thought ahead here to put that click and collect point in place, and it just seems reflective of the whole business and the way they think.
I think that's largely true. I think that, you know, they build these supermarkets on an old way of thinking that most people can't. Then they're stuck with a footprint. You know, the car park doesn't change in size, or you can change how it's, you know, laid out. But yeah, so this is one of the challenges, you know. And obviously, I suppose you can do that with slots and scheduling. And that kind of thing. I think there's a way around it.
Yeah, they just seem very late to think about. They just seem, as you say, like a follower a lot of the time. You know, yes, they're moving stuff forward, but so is everyone else, and perhaps competitors are in many respects moving things forward a little bit quicker. We've still got it on a sale. But then, you know, this has been a steady downward journey for years.
I think that's true, John, but I think we're all learning here. I think the COVID and the lockdown has really put companies on the spot, and you know, they're having to adapt very quickly to changes in circumstances. And I think we'll see a lot of improvements. I think the bottom line for me on this, John, is that I'm not sure this changes the economics of food retail and general retail dramatically to change the values of the companies in the sector in a good way.
Yeah, absolutely. Should we talk about another sector that could be somewhat exposed to COVID, which is the automotive industry? And we saw some numbers from Auto Trader this week, who's obviously the sort of front end to that industry, obviously the portal where all the dealers promote their stock. These numbers are good, and I know you've been a big fan of this company for some time. What did you make of what came out of them this week?
Yeah, I thought there was a lot to be encouraged about, not just in terms of of how resilient the business has been in a very difficult time, but how they've treated their customers, and also, you know, how they are changing in response to the changes in consumer behaviour and retail behaviour, and innovating and developing new products to serve them. I think it's very, very good. I mean, this is as, you know, insanely profitable company. It's like, you know, it's the right move of the motor industry. It's pretty much, it's a very similar business model. It's a largely, you have a, it's a web-based IT portal with a lot of fixed costs and a lot of tremendous brand power, and what's called in the financial jargon or as a network effect, in that the more people use it, the more valuable it becomes. And it becomes so valuable that if you are a car dealer or a customer, you just cannot afford not to be on that site.
And it does some really good things to keep its customers happy. So obviously COVID is a very difficult time for the car industry, but Auto Trader has responded by giving lots of the free listings. So, I mean, this is a business that, you know, it's very profitable. It can afford to do that. And obviously that's going to create a lot of goodwill with its customers.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when you've got profit margins of 70%, you've got the flexibility to be kind to your customers. And, you know, you saw it in the results, you know, where the customers were given free advertising in April and May, and then a 25% reduction in June. And that led to the sort of average rental per retailer per month, average revenue, sorry, per retail per month. That was coming down from about 1,900 to around 1,200. That all flows through to the, you know, to the revenue line. You know, you have revenues down about 37% for the half year, and profits were down 48%, I think they were down. Yet the profit margin was still 58%. Even with a halving of profit, the profit margin was still 58%. In December, they're going to give their customers another free period of advertising.
You can argue that's come at the expense of shareholders in the short term, because they've said they're not going to pay a half year dividend. Now that the second lockdown has been announced. So shareholders might be a little bit aggrieved at that, but you know, you could argue this is one of those companies that actually the story is more about growth than the dividend.
Well, yeah, I mean, dividend, you know, unlike Sainsbury's, which paid a special dividend or announced a special dividend yesterday whilst it was making 3,500 people redundant, you know, Auto Trader quite sensibly is, you know, being quite sensitive to shareholder payouts. And you're right, you know, there is a short-term pain here. But actually, what they're doing for their customers, as we rightly say, they may have no choice. But it shows that they are managing their business and trying to keep their customers on side. And at the same time, there's lots of good things going on behind the scenes. It's very interesting that, you know, they've just gone through their annual pricing round and they haven't put the prices up for the, you know, the top products. Yet, they, at the same time, they are offering more data. They're offering it more often. And therefore, the market intelligence that they're offering these car dealers is getting better. And, you know, they're also doing things like, you know, new car products where people can view cars over the internet, and things like guaranteed pricing for people who want to sell their car on the internet. And that can be that then moved into like a part exchange product for car dealerships. And then you've also got things like, you know, the financing side of it, making it easier to gain access to finance and the price of finance. So this is not a company that's abusing its dominance in the market and just creaming it. It is not resting on its laurels. and is innovating and offering its consumers and its customers more. And I think that, you know, when you're looking at a business, these are the kind of things that you want to see.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, the car industry has, as we've mentioned, been surprisingly resilient. You know, new car registrations, you know, obviously, yeah, it's been up and down, but they're looking reasonably solid. Used car sales are good. But then you could perhaps argue that Auto Trader is helping to keep this industry going. You know, if they are helping their customers in the way they are, then they're actually perhaps part of why the car industry has been as resilient as it has. It's a great story. Should we talk quickly before we wrap up? I mean, we also wanted to talk quickly about Howdens, which we like, but we know that, yeah, they've had a surprisingly good year. People have still been installing kitchens despite the effects of COVID. There was ABF, which I think you've discussed in your Alpha report. Primark's obviously taken a bit of a hit this year. It's going to have to close a lot of stores. No online offering there. That could be problematic for them.
I think it'd be very problematic. I think what was encouraging, I think, though, is how quickly this company bounced back. And it's recovered. It's actually recovered all the market share that it lost by being closed, which is, you know, regardless of what you said, people love this brand. It's incredibly popular. You know, when the stores were reopening, there were, you know, long queues of people waiting to get back in. We've talked a lot about cheap clothes in recent weeks, and, you know, you can take a view on that, but Primark still got a lot of legs, I think. You know, when we get back to normal times, this is a business that still, I think, got a lot of growth, and it's a global growth story as well. It's even though the bulk, you know, nearly half the selling space and the stores are in the UK. There's a lot that can be done rolling this model out overseas, I think.
Yeah, the shares have fallen quite heavily over the past 12 months and are looking a little bit better value than they did a year or so ago.
Definitely. I mean, these shares, you know, a couple of years ago were sort of trading, close to 35 quid a share. And they look really overpriced. Now they're down at, 16, 17 pounds a share. They trade on about, 14 times earnings, something like that. Even when you take into account, you know, the ups and downs that you get with the sugar business, which is a real pain in the backside if you're a shareholder in this, because a bad sugar year can offset, you know, the progress at Primark. I think you've got to say now that at current levels, you know, you're getting a bit, you know, that's in the price. And, you know, you've got a good grocery brands here. The food ingredients business is doing very well with yeast and bakery ingredients. And they've got an enzyme business that's making good progress. And it's a very well-managed family company. I look at AB Foods now a lot more favourably than I would have done 2 or 3 years ago, because I think the price is looking quite good.
Yeah, nice bit of value hunting. Talking of value hunting, let's round off with Senior, an engineering business in the aerospace and automotive sectors. I mean, this company's had a bit of a tough time, but you've spotted something. Tell us what you're seeing, Phil.
This is a sort of classic distressed, high risk value opportunity, potentially a trap. And you know, this is a business which makes, you know, high quality components and parts that go in aircraft engines and you know, move fuel and that kind of thing around
like
aircraft.
It's ducting, really, isn't it? It's pipes and ducting and
yeah, and then parts, you know, bits for the engines and mountings and that kind of thing.
So it must have had a horrific year then, because obviously the aerospace industry, certainly the civil aerospace industry, is largely shut down, and that's its bread and butter.
Absolutely. And the other thing as well, I mean, is that their biggest customer is Boeing, and they were selling a lot of stuff into the 737 MAX, which is the, you know, the ill-fated Boeing 737 plane that I don't think I would want to get on. But there are signs that this will, you know, hopefully eventually turn around. I mean, if you look at China, for example, you know, we've got China now where flying activity is back to pre-COVID levels. So we know that when things come out, that people do get on aeroplanes again. And I think the aerospace business is going to take some time to recover. I mean, they're not talking about production rates getting back until 2025, 2024, 2025 from where they were last year. But the companies look like it's got enough money to survive. The risk, obviously, is that it will have to raise equity. That's the big risk. But it's got a lot of contracts in place, 737 aside, to benefit from any pickup. And then you've got the other side of the business, which sells into the heavy truck industry, things like emissions products and that kind of thing. That's forecast to recover quite strongly next year. So you throw in, you know, a gradual recovery. The aerospace business is being restructured, and they reckon that's going to deliver benefits of £45 to £50 million a year. And this is a company that made £90 million last year, and is going to make virtually nothing this year. And you can see the potential for this company, which is, you know, pretty much close to its lows. I think its low was about 43p this year. And it's currently, well, last night when I was, or yesterday when I was writing, it was at 49p. It's with, for those investors that like to consider recovery type situations, something for them to, I think, to put on their watch list and dig into a bit further.
Yeah, so it's perhaps a very good example of the whole debate which is raging right now, about when value may, if ever, stage a comeback. Cheers, Phil. It's been good talking to you this morning. We'll catch up again next week.
All right, thanks a lot, Joe.
Cheers.